This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Oregon public and private sector employees, families, and communities. Protecting worker rights and fighting to improve the wages and working conditions of members since 1942. More information at www.OregonAFSCME.com. This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from SEIU Local 503 OPEU, whose mission is to improve the quality of life through worker empowerment and a progressive labor movement, and whose members deliver quality public services to Oregonians every day.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening, welcome to Labor Radio. I'm Jamie Partridge, your host this evening, filling in for Mike Crenshaw. Tonight we'll be hearing from Bill Fletcher, a nationally known labor and racial justice activist who addressed a Portland audience on the topic, How Do We Fight Back in the Age of Obama? Bill Fletcher is the past director of Trans Africa, on the editorial board of the Black Commentator, and past education director of the AFL-CIO. Bill Fletcher's latest book is They're Bankrupting Us, and 20 Other Myths About Unions.
So I want to cover a few things. One is I really want to look at the moment that we're in and then talk some about the challenge of resistance and then some suggestions on what to do. And then I look forward to our back and forth. So everybody knows intuitively, we can all feel it, that there's something very unique about the crisis that we're in right now. Everybody knows this. Some people verbalize it. Other people, you can just tell by looking at them that they know there's something unique. And that's because it's not one crisis. We're actually living in the convergence of three crises that are affecting this entire planet. And they're affecting the planet in different ways. So the one crisis that's obvious is the economic crisis. And the intensity of this crisis is brought on by the fact that it's both a structural crisis within capitalism, which we have periodically, compounded with a financial crisis that has exacerbated all of the elements that you'd find and drove us into a much, much deeper hole than anyone expected, than many people expected. And it was a financial crisis driven by an immense amount of speculation. And there were various theorists and activists that warned that building an economy based on a speculative bubble would be dangerous. But when you're riding on that speculative bubble, it's hard to get off of it. And there's millions of people right now and since 2008 who have been suffering immensely because they believe the hype in connection with the speculative bubble. So this speculative bubble collapses, and with it, millions and millions of people. So that's one crisis. The second crisis is the environmental crisis. And the New York Times report of this past Friday, I believe, saying that the CO2 in the atmosphere is greater than it's been in millions of years, not millions of days, millions of years. And that what we have to anticipate within, I think, the next 25 years are dramatic climate changes unless something is done. And the problem is that with capitalism, it's hard to imagine them turning this around because the system is on autopilot. It doesn't have to be controlled by a few fingers. The way that it operates, the nature of the system, and the constant search for more and more resources and burning up resources literally and figuratively puts us on this collision course, which is not to say that there aren't some capitalists that don't recognize that we're in trouble and that the danger that they face a danger. The question, though, is wrapped up with the nature of the system itself. So we have these two major crises, but then there's this third crisis that people don't really talk about, but we can also feel it. And it's a crisis in confidence in government. We on the left face a series of challenges on a global scale and domestically. On a global scale, the three main variations of left-wing, mass left-wing activity all found themselves in crisis by the 1980s. The welfare state and traditional social democracy was one. In the global south, what Samir Amin calls the national populist projects, many of the nationalist movements, you know, like the Egypt under Nasser or some of the national liberation movements like in Mozambique and other places. And then the pro-Soviet model, the Soviet model, Soviet bloc. All three found themselves in crises, and there was also the Maoists found themselves in crisis within a couple of years after the death of Mao. And in the global north, and particularly in Western Europe and the United States and Canada, the left did not develop a coherent strategy to achieve power. It developed, in the case of social democracy, a very successful, over several decades, strategy to introduce certain significant reforms within capitalism. But many of those reforms, or much of the success, initial success of social democracy, as Samir Amin again points out, in part was influenced by a few other things. One was the great fear that international capital had of the Soviet Union and China. A second was the domestic class struggles that were going on. And a third was cheap oil. That is, natural resources, in part because of colonialism, were very cheap. And therefore, capitalism in Western Europe and North America was able to afford certain things precisely because those resources were very available and very, very cheap. Well, national liberation struggles, national independence, and some other things made many of those resources less cheap. And the left strategies found themselves in this real dilemma because even though Western capitalism made certain concessions to their domestic working classes because of fear of the Soviet Union and China, it was precisely because of what was playing out, particularly in the Soviet Union, and what I would argue was not a form of socialism, but nevertheless waved a flag of socialism, that many people in Western Europe, North America, and other parts of the world said, I don't like capitalism, but I'm not so sure about this thing that goes by the name of socialism. And so the left found itself on a plateau. And when in the 1980s, capitalism starts to morph some and take on the characteristics of neoliberalism, that is a very intense, very barbaric, very avaricious assault on everything that had been won through the various struggles up until that point by the working class. And when it basically says we're going to eliminate all obstacles to the accumulation of capital, we found ourselves constantly on the defensive. And in that situation, much despair. But there's something else that started to happen also. Beginning in the 1970s, late 1970s, we start to see in most capitalist countries, but particularly the advanced capitalist countries, an increasing trend towards authoritarianism. Now, many of us on the left, we have overused this term fascism. I mean, basically anything from the right, we call fascists. to the point that it doesn't mean anything anymore. But the reality, as a great theorist, Poulan Zas, pointed out, is that there's various forms of right-wing movements and states. And authoritarianism does not necessarily have to take the form of fascism. But we started to see, beginning in the late 1970s, this shift. And it was linked to the growth of neoliberalism. And it's really interesting if you look back. So what you part of what this plays out as is that the space for what's considered acceptable discussion starts to shrink. Let me give you an example of what I mean. What someone might define as left-wing now might have been defined 30 years ago as at best center-left and maybe even center. When people go around talking about Bill Clinton as left, it's like I want to fall out of my chair, right? When you think back and realize that Richard Nixon's domestic program, with the exception of murdering Panthers, was to the left of Clinton and Obama. And so what we've seen is we've seen a shrinkage of acceptable space, but we've also seen the introduction of more and more elements of an authoritarian state. Restrictions on civil liberties. And this is a bipartisan issue, by the way. I mean, there's certain things that happen under Republicans and other things that happen under Democrats. And I would argue that there's certain pressures you can bring against Democrats that are harder to bring against Republicans. But in either case, under both Democrats and Republicans in the United States, we've seen the shift to the right. And, targeted assassinations, drones, the use of the NSA for domestic surveillance, going on and on, right? So we've seen this happening at the same time that neoliberal economics has been strengthening. And this is not a coincidence. I would suggest to you that this growing authoritarianism is rooted in both of the first two things that I discussed, that is, the economic crisis and the environmental crisis, that we have a state that is looking much farther down the road than most of us are and is anticipating problems. It is not becoming more authoritarian because we're strong. It's becoming more authoritarian because of what it anticipates may very well happen as these crises intensify, right? As the economic crises intensify and as the environmental crises intensify and people are fighting over more and more resources, the question is going to be, what will be the role of the state? And so we see this kind of contraction.
This is KBOO Portland. You've been listening to Bill Fletcher, a nationally known labor and racial justice activist, speaking to an audience in Portland on how do we fight back in the age of Obama.
What does this all end up meaning in terms of resistance? One of the things is that there has been and continues to be various forms of resistance. Before I get into that, let me add one other factor in this that has to do, I started mentioning this in connection with the discussion of the right wing. It has to do with this issue of race, and this is an interest. It's a transition into the question of resistance. That part of what is going on in this country is the changing demographics. And when you keep in mind that this country began as a white republic and central to its formation was the notion of an empire, first by beginning with territorial expansion and within the North America and then eventually overseas, but more importantly, other forms of control of this through this empire. But it began as a white republic. The conception was that of a white republic. And therefore, the rest of us were at best guests, and at worst interlopers. But now we have the situation where the demographics are changing very dramatically. There are all these predictions about what will happen by the middle of the 21st century in terms of this country being not a majority of anybody. Well, for the right wing, this is a very, very scary proposition. And for many so-called white Americans, it's a very scary proposition because they're not sure what exactly does this mean. And the right wing is playing this. They're playing this basic theme. And it's important for us to understand that those of us on the left that have our criticisms of Obama have to understand the nature of the right wing assaults on Obama and why this has led many African-Americans and many Latinos to be very quiet, even when they've disagreed with Obama. Because what people see is that we've heard this before. I mean, there's all these coded words that are being used to describe what is essentially this right-wing paranoid fantasy of a people of color takeover of this country. And using the figure of Obama as representing everything that these right-wingers detest about the changing demographics. Now, why I raise this is in part because I think it's important for us to grasp, but also has very important strategic and tactical implications. And one of the ways I describe this in terms of tactical implications and issues of resistance is that I talk about my mother. Now, my mother is a very, very progressive African-American woman, very progressive, very hardline trade union person, and absolutely adores Obama, absolutely adores Obama. And what I find is that I can talk with my mother about the issues and where I disagree with Obama, and I can win her over. But if I suggest a personal attack on Obama, the restaurant is closed, the lights go out, and the "we won't be back until this morning" sign comes up, right? The discussion's over. And many of us on the left don't appreciate that. And we don't appreciate, and I was in this this debate on Democracy Now on election night about some of this. The debate didn't go far enough, unfortunately. I don't think that people appreciate, for example, why African Americans turned out the way they did in election time and stood on lines for 3 or 4 hours to vote. I don't think that people understand the way that we hear the criticisms of Obama that come from the right wing. And therefore, at a strategic and tactical level, when we on the left are mounting resistance, unless we basically want to mount a resistance of the tried and true, the small but spirited rallies, we've got to figure out a way to reach people like my mother, people who are and should be the base for a mass progressive movement, if not ultimately a movement for socialism. And so it doesn't start by simply us flying the flag that we want and seeing who salutes. It's to try to figure out, well, how do we move people and what exactly are they hearing? So I think that that's important when we're thinking about resistance. The other thing is that there's an immense amount of resistance that's going on. And there's great examples. You know, whether it's the Chicago teachers strike, which I always like to parade around, is an excellent example of the kind of resistance that needs to be mounted. But there's other forms of resistance that are taking place, whether the Republic Windows and Doors takeover from a few years ago. The Occupy movement was fantastic, despite problems that I would argue that existed there. There's been various electoral upsurges. There's all the stuff that's going on. And in fact, I would suggest to you that there's a lot that's bubbling right beneath the surface. We have this immigrant rights movement that's out there that showed itself in 2006 in a way that nobody expected, but it's still there. It's all bubbling up. The question is whether it will bubble up and evaporate or whether it will bubble up like a volcano. That's the question. And so we've got to ask, when there's all this resistance going on, it's not cascading. I mean, that's the thing that's remarkable when you look at the history of the last 30 or 40 years. It's not like people have just simply been accepting the offensive against us. There's been all kinds of resistance, but it doesn't necessarily translate into collective resistance. It doesn't necessarily translate into a counteroffensive. I mean, just think about it for a second in terms of Republic windows and doors. When the workers took over, I remember that many people were saying, "Up, oh, we've got it. All right, now this is it. And now there's going to be takeovers all over the country." Not. Didn't happen. So why not? Well, there's a number of reasons. But let me point out two. The first is that it relates to something I said before. People draw conclusions based on the frame of analysis that they bring to the table. People looked at Republic windows and doors, and they saw the workers were victorious. But that didn't necessarily mean that they thought that they could be victorious. They were supporting Republic windows and doors, the workers there, but they didn't necessarily feel like this could be something that they could implement in Boise, or that this is something they could take up in Albuquerque. Now, why? Well, because part of what's missing is a political instrument that is an organization on the left that is broad enough, anti-sectarian enough, is serious enough, that ties these different struggles together and gives people in these different sites of resistance information about what's going on. And I don't mean just simply, you know, Googling stuff, but helps people to understand what actually happened, how this applies in your particular area, and what we have to do here. In the absence of organization, people will draw all kinds of conclusions. The Occupy movement was a tremendous spontaneous eruption, but it faced a challenge, and the challenge was, well, what do we do next? What's the next step? You know, we've occupied this space. Is this going to be Tahrir Square? Apparently not, right? So what do we do? And in the absence of organization, this is not going to be worked out in a park when it's raining and it's 37 degrees, right? It's just simply, that's not how it's going to happen. That's where we need this question of organization. And the question of organization becomes very, very important for those of us on the left. Now, my final point, when I'm talking about organization, I'm not just talking about yet another small left organization. You know, I'm not talking about just another organization that has its newspaper that they sell on the corner. We have to think on a completely different scale. In the last 4 or 5 years, there's been these very interesting opinion polls that actually scare the hell out of the right wing that most of us don't pay much attention to. And they basically indicate that I'm out of time. And in addition to that, they indicate that somewhere around 30% of the population, not just the youth, 30% of the population is open to alternatives to capitalism, if not something, some form of socialism. Now, before we get too excited, that doesn't mean people are ready to storm the Winter Palace or something, right? It means that there's 90 million people. Let me just repeat that. 90 million people that are thinking about the possibility of a different world. Now, most of us can barely count above 90, let alone think about 90 million and what the ramifications are. When you think about 90 million, in other words, the potential base for the development of a real left is 90 million people. There are few organizations in the United States that are above, on the left, that are above 10,000 at best. And if you're around 10,000, people think that they're in heaven. 90 million people. It means a scale of organization and an approach to organization unlike anything that we've done at least since the 1940s. It means an organization where we'll have to ask ourselves, what is the level of unity that we actually need in order to come together? to have a critical mass that influences anything. It's a kind of organization where it can't be Rocky and his friends. You know, it can't just be you and people that you like. In fact, there'll be a lot of people you don't like, but you actually are working with. We're not used to that in the left. We're used to splitting over what kind of pizza do we get? And what's the political implication of liking anchovies, right? We're not used to thinking at a scale of thousands and thousands of people. And that's our challenge. That is a challenge. And if we're not up to it, then ultimately it really means that we're really not that serious about winning. And the only thing I'm interested in is winning. You know, that's one of the reasons I'm not a postmodernist. I'm not into the idea of just continuously fighting resistance. I'm into winning. Because winning at this point in 2013 means saving humanity and making sure that humanity gets out of the 21st century and not in caves. Thank you very much.
That was Bill Fletcher, the nationally known labor and racial justice activist, addressing a Portland audience on the topic, how do we fight back in the age of Obama? We have several announcements before we let you go tonight. June 7th is the National Day of Action to Make Change at Walmart. On June 7th, hundreds of members of the organization United for Respect at Walmart will be caravanning from every corner of the country to Bentonville, Arkansas for Walmart's annual shareholders meeting. Walmart associates will call on Walmart board members and shareholders to address poverty wages, health care, retaliation against workers, and scheduling that hurts workers, customers, and the economy. There's a rally in support with Walmart workers here in Portland on June 7th, Friday, 5 p.m. to 6:15 p.m. at the Walmart on 82nd and Holgate Southeast. For more information, contact Bob Marshall at 503-701-2636. Also coming up this Sunday, June 9th at 2 p.m., Bargaining to Lift Up Education, the Schools Portland Students Deserve. Negotiations between Portland Public Schools and the Portland Association of Teachers have begun. The school district offers the most progressive contract proposal in decades, according to the Portland Association of Teachers. Portland PAT believes the school district's proposal is more about union busting than it is about providing students a better education. In contrast, the PAT believes that their proposal will help achieve a quality education for all Portland students. Join the PAT for a public forum to learn more about both contract proposals and discuss how we can achieve the schools our children deserve. That's Sunday, June 9th, 2 p.m. at the Portland Association of Teachers Hall, 345 Northeast 8th Avenue. And finally, protest privatization of the People's Public Postal Service. Dramatic action by postal protectors. Saturday, June 15th, 10 a.m. at the Portland Air Cargo Center, U.S. Postal Service, 7425 Northeast Air Trans Way, bus number 75. Save family wage jobs, union jobs, solidarity against austerity. Postal truckers, mail handlers, and clerks are losing their jobs to profiteering private corporations. Sponsored by Communities and Postal Workers United. That's Saturday, June 15th, 10 a.m. at the Portland Air Cargo Center at 7425 Northeast Air Trans Way. Call 503-752-5112 for details. And that wraps it up for Labor Radio for Monday, June 3rd, the only show of its kind in Oregon or Southwest Washington for the working class, of the working class, by the working class. Tune in next week and every Monday at 6 p.m. for Labor Radio. Thanks to our engineer, Danielle Parks, and stay tuned for Prison Pipeline.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up. It's Labor Radio.
The time is 6:29, and you're listening to KBOO, Portland 90.7 FM Community Radio. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Oregon Southwest Washington Carpenters Local 156, whose goal is to organize workers, provide a safe work environment, ensure livable wages, and elevate the moral and social condition of its members. Information at ubc156.org. Coming up next is Prison Pipeline.
Tune in to Shocks of Sheba this Thursday, June 6th at noon as we share an exclusive interview with reggae legend Max Romeo. Again, that's this Thursday, June 6th, Shocks of Sheba with Max Romeo, a KBOO exclusive.
Pride Northwest Incorporated is proud to announce its 2013 official Pride schedule of events for June 9th through 16th. We have a full week of exciting happenings designed to showcase and celebrate the LGBTQ community, including a Star Trek theme party, a special film screening, a comedy showcase, and a Tony Award-winning musical. The week will conclude with the 43rd annual Portland Pride Waterfront Festival and Parade, June 15th and 16th at Tom McCall Park. More information about the Portland Pride Festival and Parade can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can all